This is Ozarks at Large for Monday night, April 1st, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Christina Thomas will be with us in just a bit.
Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle.
All day I've been thinking I'm not going to start this part of the program off with no fooling. This is the week that we have our fundraiser.
Uh-huh.
But I'm not going to do that.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you for bringing it up, though.
Yes. This is the spring fundraiser week for KUAF. Now, we don't have phone volunteers here after 7 p.m.
No, they've all gone home.
Which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
But thanks to technology, there's a way you can, if you are a regular listener to the evening programs on KUAF, you can still contribute while you're listening to your favorite shows, be it this version of Ozarks at Large or Performance Today or the Great Classical Music Beyond.
You can do that by going to supportkuaf.com and making your contribution there.
Why is it important that someone make their contribution, whether it's right now or tomorrow morning when they call in?
Because listeners are the reason that we are able to stay on the air. As public radio, that is how public radio works. We have contributing listeners who give financial support to us so we can continue to bring them the local and national programs that they enjoy listening to.
So are you telling me, Antoinette Grajeda?
I am telling you.
That if I enjoy listening to Terry Gross and Fresh Air, that KUAF has to pay for that program?
We do. We do have to pay for that program while we do not produce it ourselves in order for us to have the right to use it. We have to pay Terry Gross's people and the people that work on that show. So we have to pay NPR for the programs that we use from NPR.
But then there's a program like Ozarks at Large, Antoinette Grajeda, in which that's not a national show. Does that still cost money?
It does still cost money because there are reporters like you and I who do have a salary.
And there are computers.
There are computers
and, there are microphones.
And equipment.
Yes.
And things that we need to have in order to produce Ozarks at Large.
And the lights above us?
Yeah, we have to pay for those too.
Okay, all right. And again, if you want to contribute right now or you enjoy listening to Terry Gross perhaps at night at 6 or classical music after us, you can do it online at supportkuaf.com.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, a conversation with writer Dave Barry. Also, a story about how bugs are related to public radio.
First, one worker was killed and three others injured after an accident at a nuclear power plant in Russellville yesterday morning. The workers were performing regular maintenance at Arkansas Nuclear One, owned by Entergy Arkansas. Terry Young is a spokesman for the facility.
As we were moving a generator stator, which is a very large component at Arkansas Nuclear One, that stator fell as it was being moved out of the turbine building.
Young says Entergy is deeply saddened by the loss of one of its employees. He says the accident poses no danger to the public and no radiation was released. Entergy, along with state and federal officials, will be conducting an investigation into the cause of the accident.
Officials with the Arkansas Department of Workforce Services report the unemployment rate in the state remained unchanged during the month of February. Kimberly Friedman with the agency says labor statistics show unemployment held steady at 7.2%, while the national jobless rate dropped from 7.9% in January to 7.7% in February.
Looking at February of this year, total non-farm jobs actually increased 7,600. We saw that seven major sectors posted gains, three actually declined, and one industry remained the same. The government industry added 5,200 jobs, but most of that increase occurred in state government as public school employment returned to normal levels after the winter break.
Friedman says more than 96,000 Arkansans were unemployed during February.
April is National Sexual Assault Awareness and Prevention Month. In his weekly radio address, Governor Mike Beebe says aside from the personal toll it takes on victims, everyone ends up paying for sexual violence, regardless of whether there is a personal connection to the victims or not. The governor says some of those societal costs include increased police and investigative costs, offender treatment programs, and health care for victims.
Sexual assault is considered to be the most underreported violent crime in America. Victims hesitate to report these crimes for fear of skepticism or failure to bring the perpetrator to justice. We want our police, prosecutors, and courts to treat victims with the respect they need and deserve. However, anxiety causes many victims to never report the offense and leaves our law enforcement and legal systems unable to provide necessary action and assistance.
There is more information about preventing sexual violence at the website for the Arkansas Coalition Against Sexual Assault, or ACASA. www.ozarkfoothills.us.
The Ozark Foothills Film Festival begins Wednesday, April 3rd, and runs through Sunday, April 7th. The annual event is in Batesville and will show more than 30 films from directors across the nation. The historic Landers Theater will screen many of the films. Bob Pest is the president of the Film Fest organization, and he hopes to attract interesting and unique films, including those that are locally produced.
One of the things we do have is we have an Arkansas showcase, which we always have. And we have 10 films by Arkansas filmmakers. Several of them are university professors, and the rest of them are just filmmakers in Arkansas who are sort of trying to work their way to the top.
This year's theme is Women Directors. For more information, visit OzarkFoothillsFilmFest.org.
Razorback baseball team now 6-3 in SEC play. The Diamond Hogs won 2 of 3 against SEC rival Mississippi State this weekend in Fayetteville. Mississippi State came into the weekend ranked 15th in the country. Arkansas won Friday's game 5-4, lost 4-1 on Saturday, and the Razorbacks won yesterday afternoon 3-1 to clinch the 3-game series. Arkansas returns to action Thursday, another SEC series. They'll be at Alabama.
Mostly cloudy tonight with a 40% chance of rain and lows from 40 degrees in northwest Arkansas to 46 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow there is a 100% chance of rain. Expect between a half and three quarters of an inch of rain with highs from 45 degrees in northwest Arkansas to 49 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow night expect more rain with an 80% chance of precipitation and lows from 36 degrees in northwest Arkansas to 41 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Expected rainfall amounts will be between a quarter and 1/2 of an inch.
This is Ozarks at Large. Last week, the future of a proposed steel mill project in Arkansas was just one item legislators paid attention to in Little Rock. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas covers the past 7 days of Arkansas's business and politics in his regular Monday rundown.
Grant Tenniel, executive director of the Arkansas Economic Development Commission, says if Arkansas lawmakers don't move forward on the $1.1 billion Big River Steel Super Project, it will kill the deal. He also was asked if turning the project down would diminish the ability of Arkansas to recruit similar projects in the future. He said it would depend on whether or not we sent the message that we are intolerant of any risk at all. If that was the case, he said, quote, I don't think we'll get an opportunity to look at another project. Walmart store said it incurred $157 million in expenses during fiscal year 2013 relating to the ongoing investigations linked to alleged violations of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in several of its international markets. The retailer expects those costs will escalate as the investigation has expanded from Mexico, where it originated, and now includes probes in Brazil, India, and China. Walmart officials also announced plans to begin testing the use of self-service storage lockers in a limited number of stores this summer. With more than 4,000 U.S. locations, Walmart has a clear advantage for rapid order fulfillment if details are worked out and the entire store network is involved in the locker model. Many of those stores are also open 24 hours a day, which provides more convenience for shoppers. New numbers released from the Department of Human Services indicate the private insurance option being considered by lawmakers could save the state $670 million over the next decade. On Wednesday, DHS released actuarial figures that show the private option would save that dollar amount. House Speaker Davey Carter received approval for his capital gains tax cut bill, HB 1966, which raises the exemption level on new and existing investments. The House Revenue and Tax Committee approved the measure on a voice vote on Tuesday afternoon. The bill moves the capital gains tax exemption from 30% to 70% on two sets of investments. The first level of investment involves new investments starting July 1, 2013. The bill also moves the exemption level to 70% on existing investments in excess of $5 million. The Department of Finance and Administration estimated that the tax could cut state revenues by $3.1 million in year one, $10 million in year two, nearly $18 million in year three. Atlanta-based Phoenix Metals Company plans to invest $12 million in a new 65,000-square-foot metal processing and service operation at Chaffee Crossing in Fort Smith that could employ up to 40 with an average wage of $15 per hour. The deal was finalized on Thursday. Phoenix Metals has 12 operations, including a processing site in Russellville. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Arkansas update.
Lawmakers are back for what could be a six-day week following new developments last week and two of the legislature's biggest decisions of this session: the state's Medicaid program and whether to approve $125 million in state investment in a steel mill in northeast Arkansas. Nathan Vandiver from our content partner KUAR has more.
Legislative leaders say this week they may be at the Capitol on Saturday. Reports indicate insistence from leaders that the threat of a long week is not an April Fool's joke, but an assessment of the amount of work the body has ahead of it before the session's April 19 deadline. Last week, lawmakers asked questions for 5.5 hours in a meeting regarding a billion-dollar steel mill project that would require state investment. This week, lawmakers have a full bill to consider regarding the Big River Steel project, which could bring over 500 jobs to the state. Also, a group of bills addressing the state's current Medicaid program are moving through the Capitol, and lawmakers continue to weigh the possibility of expanding health insurance for the state's working poor with federal money through the Affordable Care Act. A House committee last week advanced two key tax-cutting measures that the governor continues to say could be offset by accepting federal money for health insurance expansion. Many Republican legislators continue to voice skepticism regarding expanding health coverage, but have agreed it could create an offset for lost revenue due to tax cuts. These issues, proposed constitutional amendments, and the state budget are just part of the work left for lawmakers as they have a little more than 2 weeks to go. In Little Rock, I'm Nathan Vandiver.
It's about 18 minutes after 7 o'clock. This is a Monday evening edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Also with me during this hour, my colleagues and co-producers of the program, Christina Thomas and Antoinette Grajeda. This is a special week at KUAF. It's the spring fundraiser. And though we've sent our phone volunteers home for the evening, there is still a way that you can make your contribution to KUAF right now. You can do so quickly and quietly and securely at our website, supportkuaf.com. Support comes from listeners of KUAF who contribute their financial gifts because they know, like you know, that without our listener contributions, we would be unable to keep bringing you the programs like Fresh Air or Ozarks at Large. One of the things we're happiest about with the daily edition of Ozarks at Large, now about 2.5 months since we've been doing this, is the expanded coverage we can give you throughout the week of legislative issues, things that are taking place, being debated at the state capitol, whether it's expanded Medicaid, whether it's the environment, whether it's guns on university campuses in Arkansas. We've been able to bring you detailed conversations with lawmakers on both sides of the issue and talk to others about what proposed legislation might mean. If you appreciate expanded legislative coverage, as well as expanded coverage from throughout your region, your hometown, every day on KUAF, please know that we can only do it, continue to do it, with your support. And you can support us right now online at supportkuaf.com. We thank you very much for your financial support. And ahead on tonight's edition of Ozarks at Large, a conversation with Dave Barry, the Pulitzer Prize winner, will be at the Fayetteville Public Library later this month. In just a moment, Antoinette Grajeda will talk with Becca Martin-Brown from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers about some things that are coming up in the next 48 hours or so. Speaking of events coming up, Eureka House Concerts will present Small Potatoes Sunday. The energetic Chicago duo has been entertaining audiences for about 20 years. Their music covers everything from Celtic to cowboy. Doors will open at 5 Sunday evening for a meet-and-greet potluck. The music will start an hour later at 6. For more information, you can call 244-0123 or eurekahouseconcerts.com. And the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality will hold a public meeting Wednesday, May 8th at 6 p.m. in Jasper. The idea is to discuss the proposed farming near the Buffalo National River area. It will take place in the Carroll Electric Building. For more information, buffaloriveralliance.org. This is a Monday night edition of Ozarks at Large. I now turn it over to my colleague Antoinette Grajeda.
Thanks, Kyle. Joining me now, as she does most days, Becca Martin Brown from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers, here to tell us about some entertainment.
Tomorrow at 6:30, that guy, Kyle Kellums, is going to be the MC for another Theater Squared Artists Forum. This time they'll be talking about Next to Normal, the play that's coming up this month, and that happens at the Fayetteville Public Library. You might have heard of the performers that will be at the Walton Arts Center tomorrow night. A little group called Cool and the Gang.
I think I've heard of them.
Okay, maybe Antoinette hasn't heard of them.
I've heard of them.
Old people like me have heard of them. You might remember songs like Celebration.
Mm-hmm.
They are performing at 7:30 Tuesday at the Art Center as headliner of the Washington Regional Foundation Gala. Tickets are $75 but include all sort of coolness besides the concert. And you can find out more at 443-5600.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Kyle?
This is Ozarks at Large. If you've been waiting for a novel set in Miami with four good friends, a python, an orangutan, a Haitian family seeking a better life, an inexplicable car audio system, a wedding tilting toward disaster, brownies that inspire an odd friendship, and the line, hyperactive poo-flinging banshee, well, your wait is over. If, less specifically, you've just been waiting for the next crime-tinged novel from Dave Barry, then more good news. Insane City is now available. Even better news, Dave Barry is coming to Fayetteville. He'll speak at the Fayetteville Public Library April 12th at 7, sign books afterward. He's with me on the phone now. Dave Barry, welcome, and thanks for taking some time to talk.
Thank you, and thank you for that incredibly descriptive summary of my book.
Well, let's talk about that line from page 104, hyperactive poo-flinging banshee. This refers to an idiosyncratic behavior in an idiosyncratic city where you describe a lot of people, I think both in fictional Miami of your novel and the real Miami, adopt monkeys and think this will be a good idea.
Yeah, people in Miami have a very strange notion of what would be an appropriate household pet. Monkeys is one example. Sometimes tigers, which, I mean, you would think most people would figure out, even though tigers are very cute when they're little, they do grow up. And apparently this does not occur to everybody. Probably our most flagrant example of late has been pythons. We have a python problem. These are Burmese pythons. They're not supposed to be here. They're supposed to be in Burma. I don't know where that is, but that's where they should be. And instead, people bring them here as pets, even though these are snakes. They get to be, they're constrictor snakes, get to be 15 feet long, even longer sometimes. People somehow think that that's a good idea to have in their house. Then eventually, I guess they run out of crack or whatever, and they go, oh, my God, I've got a giant snake. And they let it go. And the result of that has been that the Everglades are infested with Burmese pythons. They have no natural enemies out there. And it has gotten so bad, there's supposedly 100,000 of them or more, it's gotten so bad that the state of Florida, State Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, stepped in and held a contest called the Python Challenge, which could only have been thought of by the state of Florida, the same state they can't figure out who it's voted for in an election. Where we invited anybody who wanted to come from anywhere to come down here and kill our pythons. It did not work out. Unfortunately, the pythons won the python challenge, but we tried.
But as you so ably point out in your novels, the fact that Florida and Miami and South Florida have idiosyncrasies and people who have odd choices for hobbies and interests, that's just great for a novel.
It is. It's ideal. And I want to stress that I know that every place has idiosyncrasies and every place has weird behavior. But I just contend there's no place where it's as densely populated with that kind of person as Florida. And it is an ideal environment, very target-rich environment for a fiction writer. The great Carl Hiaasen, you know, probably the king of the South Florida wacko writing, Florida wacko, has said you don't really need an imagination to think of a plot for a novel in Florida. You just need a subscription to the newspaper. And whatever you think of, however weird you think it is, something weirder will happen, but, you know, in time, and make whatever you wrote seem kind of tame.
so many of these elements play out in Insane City. It's a wedding. It's Seth, who is kind of this good-natured schlub. He's getting married to a very intense young woman who comes from a very wealthy family. As I mentioned, and you mentioned, there's a python, there's an orangutan that ends up with...
There's an orangutan who is not only plays an important role in the plot, but he becomes sort of a love interest in the book. He gets out of his cage. He's been in a cage a long time, if you know what I mean. So he's a lonely orangutan, and he's not really that hung up on any particular species, if you notice. He's open to an open relationship. Let's put it that way.
And how can we say, an aphrodisiac for him is having attention paid to him.
Yes, well, or being anywhere near any female of any species really is good enough for Trevor. His name is Trevor.
And we like Trevor. We get to know Trevor.
I love Trevor. In fact, when I wrote the book originally, Trevor's role was fairly minor. The story is about a wedding that goes really badly wrong, and the hero of the book is the groom, and he has a number of problems, the obstacles placed in his path. And early on, one of them is that he loses the wedding ring, which was trusted to him by the bride, who hasn't trusted him with much else.
It's his one job.
It's his one job, is to show up with this ring. It's incredibly valuable. She's very rich. Her family's rich. And she has had made this incredibly valuable ring. That's all he's supposed to do. Unfortunately, when he arrives in Miami, he and his groom posse, they try to get to the hotel. They make an honest effort. But Miami is the kind of city where you could get in a cab and the driver will not know where your hotel is. And I say this because it has happened to me here in Miami. I don't understand why we have cab drivers who don't know how to find things, because you'd think that would be a fundamental requirement of the job. But here in Miami, that's not always given. Anyway, they end up in South Beach instead of where they're trying to get, which is Key Biscayne. And they end up at a bar called the Clevelander, which is a real bar, although it's got nothing to do with Cleveland. And one thing leads to another, and Seth loses his wedding ring that night. And through a series of circumstances I won't go too far into, because I don't want to give too much of the plot away, but it winds up in the hands of Trevor, the orangutan, who resides at a tourist attraction called Primate Encounter. And this is one of the many things Seth has to do in this book, is try to get his ring back from Trevor. But I really originally anticipated Trevor as just that one scene where Seth, the groom, has to get his... You know, I thought it would be funny, you know, mm-hmm. in the middle of the night, the groom has to get his ring back from an orangutan. But I like Trevor so much. He was such a great personality that I kept him in the book, and he ends up, as I say, playing quite an important role.
You know, there is this sort of Rube Goldberg mechanism going on with how many things go wrong.
Yeah.
Because we've heard just a hint of the problems.
And that is just one minor issue that Seth has to deal with. And, you know, the thing that the author that I most love to read for fiction is P.G. Wodehouse. And that's I love those Blanding's Castle romps where there's 23 characters all trying to do something different, everybody confused, nobody knows quite what's going on, bouncing off each other sort of frantically. I love that kind of plot. So that was kind of my model when I wrote this book.
Well, but the thing with a Rube Goldberg machine, of course, is for it to all work, it all has to work separately. And so all these parts have to work, and you have to, it seems like to me, walk toward the edge of ruining our suspension of disbelief, but you never do. It all makes sense how this can happen.
Well, you kind of have to lure the reader step at a time into okay, this could happen, then this could happen. Because I know when I say, well, an orangutan gets the wedding ring, it sounds like, well, how'd that happen? You know, but you have, you know, that's your job as a writer. First this happens, then this happens, then this happens, then this happens, and lo and behold, the reader is at this point right there with you. Yeah, the orangutan ends up with a wedding ring. I can see that. You know?
Of course he's in the parking lot of a strip club.
Likewise, you could have a pirate ship being chased by a tour boat, and that which ends up in a fight involving frozen chicken nuggets being fired from a cannon. That could happen.
It all makes sense when you get there. There is another one of the subplots and things that are keeping, and actually is responsible for the transformation of the main character, Seth, to take him from likable slacker to something different, is a Haitian mother and her two children who are seeking a better life in the U.S., which doesn't sound on the surface as funny and doesn't really play funny in the book, but it serves a big purpose, doesn't it?
Yeah. Really, the heart of the book is a very serious story. And it's not a serious book. It's a comedy. But Seth, our guy, our hero, who's kind of a loser, but certainly not an ambitious human being, not an issues guy, not a cause guy, ends up on his wedding weekend rescuing this Haitian woman who, because of the law, the immigration law, if she is turned over to the police, she and her children will be sent back to Haiti. That's the way the law works here in Miami, or in the United States. And so he has this, suddenly he's responsible for this Haitian refugee family. And that is kind of the beating heart of the plot. And Seth, the way Seth handles that, that responsibility that is going to basically threaten his wedding on his wedding weekend is what sort of drives the book in the end, and what Seth has to do about that. Surrounding that is a great deal of comedy, but you're right. At the heart of it, it's a pretty serious, that part of the story is serious.
You know, I think back to Big Trouble, which was your first novel intended for an adult audience, and you have Puggy, who is the sort of homeless drifter who lives in a tree. You seem to have a soft spot for underdogs.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you really, I think most books, if you're going to get people to want it, to root for your characters, to care about them, you have to make them, less than perfect. They have to face obstacles. They have to deal with problems and overcome challenges. Otherwise, really, what's the story if it's just, this perfect person has a perfect day? There isn't really much of interest in that, which is why people read. It's why people watch TV. Why people watch Downton Abbey, because they know that in every episode problems are going to arise, and these characters they've come to know will have to deal with them, and how will they deal with them? And so, sort of the essence of keeping the story interesting to people is to put problems in people's paths. And it's good to have an underdog, I think, anyway, as your protagonist. Because that's where people's sympathies lie, and that's what they identify with.
Should point out that Insane City has a lower body count than Downton Abbey.
Yeah, that's true. Nobody dies in my book. In fact, there really isn't that much violence. There's some threats of violence, and there's some people who are not that wonderful. But it isn't one of those books where the bad guy is shooting everybody.
No. It's funny, in the foreword to Big Trouble, which is when you launched this part of your career with these kinds of novels, you point out, younger readers should stop now because you've done so many books. And you said, because you have some characters who use adult language, you as the writer didn't want them to, but as characters they did. I have heard other writers talk about sometimes characters doing things they didn't expect. Does that actually happen?
Yeah, the first person to tell me that was one of my heroes, Elmore Leonard. And I got to know him, and one night I ended up in this long conversation about, writing characters, and he was saying that, you will not necessarily know, and you'll see this in his books, you'll not necessarily know when you're writing the first chapter or two which of these characters is really going to be important, which one is just going to disappear. And you'll also not really know what they're going to do. You think you do, but sometimes they take on, once you started writing them, you feel as though you're more channeling them. And they do things you don't expect them to do. One of the characters in this book, her name is Cindy. When I started writing the book, in my mind, she was a minor character. And she ends up being a major character, kind of because of the way she acted.
Right.
Which I know sounds weird, because obviously I'm writing the words she's saying. I'm writing what she does. But, you sort of have this image in your mind of this person. What would that person do? And the person sort of tells you, well, I would do this. I would say that.
So there's this actual evolution?
Huh?
There's this actual evolution of the characters?
Well, yeah. Especially in this case, the main character, Seth, he changes. I mean, and he really changes. Most of the other characters don't so much. But he learns a major lesson, discovers something really important about himself, which I knew from the beginning I wanted to have happen. I wanted two things. I wanted the character to change, and I wanted the ending to be kind of a surprise. So that was the only thing I was really sure of. I knew how I wanted it to end, and I didn't want you to expect it. And I knew that I wanted Seth to become a different person in the course of the book.
Finally, you mentioned Carl Hassan, you mentioned Elmore Leonard, and I know that you're friends and the former bandmate of Stephen King. It seems as though, just from looking at the blurbs and the conversations and interviews I've read, that you guys do not have professional jealousy of each other.
I don't. I guess it can happen. In the book world, I know if you're in a specific genre, like I think murder mystery writers pay a lot of attention to where other murder mystery writers are on the bestseller list and how, you know, that kind of thing. But I don't know. I think I've always been kind of comfortable with my role in life as a writer. I was mostly a humor columnist, not really a book writer. So any success I have with books makes me happy. And Carl is my friend. He's been my friend for a long time. I'm not going to be jealous of Carl's success. I'm happy for Carl. I love Carl's books. You know, he's a good guy. He's my friend. So I don't view it as a competition. People could buy Carl's books, and they could also buy my book. It's not like a Stephen King. Now, if I wanted to be in a competition with him, I'd be an idiot. Since he could write a grocery list and sell 20 million times more than I can. And he's also a really good guy, you know, and also a completely different genre. So, yeah, it's easier. It's like anything else. You're not really, if you think about it, you're not really competing with anybody else. There's the audience out there is vast. You know, there's room for a lot of writers.
The new book is Insane City. It's available now. Dave Barry will be at the Fayetteville Public Library April 12th, beginning at 7. Dave Barry, thanks so much for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
In winter, we hear a few chirps here and there, but with spring upon us, our feathered co-inhabitants are vocally staking their nesting claims. And next on Ozarks at Large, Birdman Joe Neal waxes on about the call of the cardinal.
It's 5:30 a.m. and still dark in the Ozarks. I'm out on my front steps. In the east, fading stars and first light. In the west, a block away, first garbage truck. Dumping and moving on. Then silence. Then first bird tuning up. It's his immaculate redness, a cardinal. Or as we often call him here, Red Bird. Here's one singing now at Frisco Spring in Rogers. You may already be prematurely up and out of bed trying to figure out which bird sings first. But in a world of many troubles, is not pursuit of the first morning singer a little obsessive? It's a work day, a school day, and you're up listening to birds? You have my sympathy. You, or I should say, we, are bird crazy. We don't have to admit this to anyone. It can just be our secret. In my neighborhood, it's all Redbird. He's on a low limb right above the bushes. He beat the robins and the wrens. He beats the mockingbird and the sparrows. It's Redbird 1, all others 0. Those other birds don't have a chance, and neither do I. I just can't stay in bed. I'm out on the porch in my socks and in the cold. I can hear it all happening. He's got the day by the tail. He lets us know. We've had a big feeder scene in my front yard this winter. Red birds can't get enough black oil sunflower seeds. Yep, that's me at the feed and seed store buying another 40-pound sack of red bird food. Sometimes I feed as many as 12 to 15. But winter's breaking up, and so is peace and quiet among redbirds. One big male with his sharp red crest and his bold black mask drives another off the feeder. Females sneak in for seeds while the males brawl. In the following recording, a redbird swaps off singing with a Carolina wren and other birds in my yard. At some point, we are going to have leaves enough on the bushes to hide a nest. At that point, likely early April, I expect I will see Lady Redbird sneak across the yard with a twig in her beak, headed for the bushes. Meanwhile, his lordship, the great Red Bird of Cleburne Street, thrones up in a smart spot right out in the open. You've seen the resplendent red feathers. Montezuma never had it so good. Now just listen to him sing.
Joe Neal is co-author of Arkansas Birds, published by the University of Arkansas Press. His latest book, In the Province of Birds, a Western Arkansas memoir, is published by Half Acre Press.
And this is the evening edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Ahead in a few minutes, we're going to hear about the Big Picture House, that project that's going on in Northwest Arkansas and has been for some time. But before that, Christina, we're going to find out a little bit about how the insect world relates to the fundraising world.
Right. Well, today is the first day of our spring on-air fundraiser.
Right.
And I do a monthly series with an entomologist at the University of Arkansas. We talk about, all things bugs.
Right.
And it got me thinking, our listeners, we have to attract our listeners.
Very much so, yes.
Right. And insects have to attract one another. So we,
if they're going to procreate, right?
If they're
going
to procreate, yes. And they do. I mean, summertime's coming up, and we're going to see bugs, lots of bugs. But it got me thinking. You know, we have to court our listeners. We have to attract our listeners. So I asked Dr. Donald Steinkraus, again entomologist at the University of Arkansas, to tell me a little bit about how certain bugs attract each other. Do you know what a pheromone is?
I do. I have the basic knowledge. It's a scent.
Mm-hmm.
That somehow makes another being interested.
Right, right.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a chemical. It's a chemical. And here's this conversation.
Primary example of that is the giant Saturniid moths. We talked about those once before. You found a
When we went out and did wintering, overwintering.
Yeah, found one, a Cecropia cocoon.
Right.
But this is a female Cecropia, and this is a male Cecropia.
Also, the robin.
It's called a robin moth.
Robin moth.
The Luna moth is in that group, and the Polyphemus moth. So these are called the giant silkworm moths of North America and the world. And if you look at the male, his antennae are much bigger. So you can immediately distinguish the males of these from the females by their very much wider antennae. And these antennae are used to sift out of the air the female's sex pheromone. So the female has much smaller antennae because she doesn't have to find the male. The male has to find her. And the way it works is when a female climbs out of her cocoon, she doesn't move or leave that area because she immediately puts out her glands on the end of her abdomen, which puts out this sex pheromone, which wafts through the air. Now, because moths are nocturnal, they can't use visual cues to find each other. So the male, in complete darkness, can detect a female from several miles away, and he zigzags back and forth in the plume of her pheromone, following the concentration, and will find her in total darkness, and then when he gets close to her, he'll mate with her.
So she doesn't. So immediately when she comes out of her cocoon, she's mature. She's ready.
That's right. Oh, that's right. With this type of moth, the eggs are already mature inside of her abdomen, and ready to be. Well, they can be fertilized. But if she left her cocoon area and flew all around, the male wouldn't be able to find her. So in this group of moths, this extremely powerful sex pheromone is put out, and males from all over, miles away, will go through darkness to find her. Now, that'd be amazing if, like, a human could do that. It'd be as if, like, you know, a man could find his wife 10 miles away in complete darkness just by her scent and find that specific person or something. It's like, so this male will come to this female and not to the Luna moth female. And because there's a different blend of pheromones that she puts out. So it's and it does it by smelling the pheromone on his antennae. They have little tiny sensilli on their antennae, which are like a lock and key. The pheromone binds to a receptor site, causes the neuron to fire, goes to his brain, and he can detect extremely minute amounts of this pheromone.
Well, his antennae kind of look like, just for kind of trying to visualize for our listeners, it sort of looks like maybe a leaf of a fern.
True.
Maybe.
Or a little feather.
Yeah.
They're very beautiful. In fact, each of these antennae have about 60,000 of these little sensilli on them. So if you looked at them with an electron microscope, you could see all these little sensory cells, these olfactory, they detect olfactory things. That's the pheromone, mm-hmm. is olfactory, it's smell. But, you know, it'd be an amazing thing if a human could do the same thing. I mean, mm-hmm. and there have been people that search for that with humans, you know, that can we... I mean, some of the perfumes men supposedly wear musks
right.
and things, right?
Manly smells.
Manly smells. And then women wear pheromones, I mean, yeah. perfumes, which mm-hmm. be in a sense like an attractive thing. A man might notice her from a distance,
yeah.
correct?
I think so, yeah. yeah.
So anyway, pheromones are extremely important. Actually, entomologists have spent a lot of time synthesizing these with chemists. You can actually study these pheromones and synthesize them chemically, and then they're actually used sometimes in mating disruption. Like if you were to take the pheromone from a silkworm moth and spread it all over the place in little pieces of plastic, the male would get distracted. He wouldn't be able to find mm-hmm. the female because he'd be smelling her everywhere. And so they're actually used in pest control tactics.
Ah.
And, see what I mean by they'll take an orchard or a vineyard and they'll spread the sex pheromone all over the place, and the males come in, they can't find the female. So they can't mate, and then the females...
And then there are no...
She can't lay fertile eggs.
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot of unique things about mm-hmm. the insect world. And so anyway, that's the silkworm strategy. It's this very, very elaborate... Yeah, it's really beautiful.
Well, and I like that I was already familiar with this moth, too.
Because
so.
You'd found the cocoon.
Right.
You were very sharp-eyed.
Dr. Donald Steinkraus is an entomologist at the University of Arkansas. I spoke with him last week.
I love that conversation because it has. This is during the daytime. We're encouraging people to call in to make their
right.
financial. We don't have people by the phones tonight.
No,
they've gone home. We've sent our volunteers home, but you can do it 24/7 online at supportkuaf.com.
Yes.
All the questions that need to be answered are right there. It's a safe and secure website, supportkuaf.com. I love this conversation that you had with Don Steinkraus because there are similarities.
Mm-hmm.
We try, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, we try to attract people, get them interested, and then have listeners realize how important a service it is to know about the rest of the world, whether it's All Things Considered or your region, your town with Ozarks at Large. And so you have to make that initial attraction.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Put up good radio.
Right. And we're putting off a signal.
Right.
We can't do a smell.
No.
But yes,
not
but
yet.
We put out a signal.
Yeah. Not yet.
Maybe someday.
Well,
technology is ever improving.
Here is a big difference, I think, between the insect world and the fundraising world, at least the public radio fundraising world. With the insects, it's a little bit of trickery. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're putting this out there, and then because you think it's great, you swoop in. We don't try that so much. We say, do you like this? Now think about it.
Right.
And do you want to?
Do you want to give? Do you want to contribute? Do you want to support what we are putting out there?
Right.
I also like this story because this particular moth, when it emerges from its cocoon, stays in one spot so that the male knows where to go. And
makes sense.
Yeah. And our listeners know where to find us. We are always at 91.3 FM or listening online. You can listen online at KUAF.com. So you don't, we're not tricking you. You know,
we're
there all the time.
Now, later during this fundraiser, you'll have another conversation with Don Steinkraus.
Yes.
Can you give us a hint?
Well, as we're approaching summer, mm-hmm. The nighttime sounds, you hear insects at night. And so the next bug that we talk about uses sound to attract its mate.
That's an even closer relationship
yes,
with us.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the sounds that attract insects might not be quite the same that attract you mm-hmm. to your public radio station, your favorite public radio station, but we hope that they do attract you and you can support us online.
At supportkuaf.com.
Thank you, Christina.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Ozarks at Large. Rachna Muldoon moved to Northwest Arkansas last fall and became quickly enamored with the art scene. But she wanted one more thing. So she's rolled up her sleeves and has started to work.
When I first came to Fayetteville in September, and I was like so pleasantly surprised with the amount of art and creativity that was here, I had never even been to Arkansas. And so obviously I was terrified as to what I would find. And I was just so, it was just so charming. And there was so much theater. I went to go see Theater Squared, and I was just so impressed. But I was looking around and thinking, like, where's the film here, you know, aside from the big megaplexes? And it just felt like that was the missing piece. And it was kind of perfect for me because this idea happened, the idea for the Big Picture House happened to me back in 2009. I was on a trip to New Zealand, and we had been doing like white water rafting and hiking and all these things, and we just wanted like a quiet night. And we stumbled upon this theater that was in this old house, and you know, they were showing a foreign film. I don't even remember the name, but there was a great film, there was wine, there was cheese, chocolate. It was like the triple threat of wonderful in my life. You know, I loved it. And I thought, I really want to do something like this. And that was back then. And I sort of toyed around with the idea for a long time and thinking about what I wanted it to be. And, you know, for me, the Big Picture House isn't just about film. It's meant to be a true art house. It's really the vision is to create like a very comfortable connection with the community through film and through small theater performances and through events. So that's really how I was inspired. And when I got to Fayetteville, I thought, gosh, it's so serendipitous that it is really the one thing missing from downtown Fayetteville, from the heart of the city.
It seems like you have a very measured trajectory here. You're starting small, getting people interested, and building towards something.
Absolutely. You know, I didn't want to go in and get a space and just open it up and say, hey, come to my movie theater, because what makes it different? I really wanted to start to collaborate with the local businesses here and the local art groups here and get to know the audience. You know, I'm so new to Fayetteville, and I learned quickly that it is a lot different than Houston. It is a lot different than New York, where I also live. So I'm really trying to get to know the community and where this would fit in into the community and how it would fit in. So Nightbird Books has graciously allowed me to make a temporary home in their breezeway. And we have had a blast doing movie nights that are pay what you want. I really am doing this in as a way to get feedback from the community. What kinds of movies do people want to see? Do people want to bring their kids? Do people want events that are just tailored around grown-ups? You know, so this is my baby steps into starting a business here.
I know the movies that you had in the breezeway at Nightbird Books have included, I think, Pretty in Pink.
Yeah, well, actually, Pretty in Pink was a fun one. We also collaborated with the Artist Laboratory Theater, and we were in the Sheep Fort, which was this phenomenal place. They built an actual sheep fort, like you would when you were 8 years old, like with your siblings, and they built it in, but giant, in a warehouse at the BN Limited Theater. So we did Throwback Thursdays, and we did The Goonies and Pretty in Pink, and we had an 80s costume contest, which was a blast, because you saw parents bring their children to see their childhood favorites. At Nightbirds, though, we've done some great things. Try to make it very unique. For example, on Valentine's Day, we did Lars and the Real Girl, which is, I thought it was such a sweet choice because it's very romantic. So it's a great, unique date night for Valentine's Day. But at the same time, you know, if you didn't have a date, Ryan Gosling is dating a blow-up doll. So you're doing better, you know, than he is. So we thought that was a great choice for Valentine's Day. We've been doing stuff that's centered around some of the holidays, and we've just been doing things that are kind of just random stuff that people just email me and say, I never got to see this. This never had a wide release in Fayetteville, and I'll find it.
So you've talked about the baby steps. What steps do you hope to achieve in the next year or two, or do you have a timeline like that?
I do and I don't. You know, I know in terms of what projects I want to achieve, but in terms of, you know, having my own space or how big I want this to get, I really kind of want it to take its own time and do what it will. We've been just trying to do a lot of very unique things. For instance, with Nightbirds, we started the Read It, Watch It club, which was phenomenal. You know, we pick a book, a great book that's been turned into a great movie, and we read the book, and then a month later we get together and watch the movie. And some people choose to do it the opposite. They watch the movie and then they'll read the book. But either way, it's been great. We did Winter's Bone to start it off, which is just very classic Ozarks, and
yes,
was perfect. We did it in January. And one of the lead actresses from the movie, Lawrence Sweetser, actually came to the event. She was wonderful. We all had wine together, you know, everybody who was there to watch the movie. And she sat and talked to us about what it was like to make this really low-budget movie that became an Oscar nominee. And she gave us all kinds of background stories, so it made watching the movie a lot more fun. So events like that have been really, really great for us, and have brought in different kinds of people, book lovers and film lovers and just people who are looking to do something different on a Thursday night. And the other thing I'm trying to do definitely within the next year is to branch out what the programming really is. Eventually, I want it to be a very true art house, you know, not just film. I understand people don't want to watch a movie every single night, but I think people do want to have an option to do something every single night. So one of the things that we've also started is a great storytelling series called Speak for Yourself. And this is a collaboration between the Artist Laboratory Theater and the Big Picture House. We did it in the Sheep Fort, and it was truly a magical experience. I mean, anyone who went, it was standing room only. The community came out. People put their name in a hat, and basically if you get drawn, you have 3 to 5 minutes to just tell a simple story, an honest story about a time that impacted your life. And it wasn't meant to be a performance. It's not poetry. You can't even bring a sheet of paper
notes
up. That,
right.
Nothing.
Right.
Similar to the Moth podcast, which is really popular, and I can definitely see why. Ours was very unique because we had a local improv group called Sound Effects. They're a musical improv group. At the end of the storytelling series, they did a set which was very loosely based off of the stories they heard.
Fun.
Oh my gosh, great. We had people were just crying laughing. It was really amazing. So we're looking forward to doing Speak for Yourself some more also.
But don't have a next date yet.
Actually, if you go to our Facebook page, it's facebook.com/bigpicturehouse. Pretty easy. I have all the events there. We have stuff planned out at Nightbirds through September. So the movie book club, it starts to involve some children's books in the summer to get the kids involved. And starting, I think, in May, the movies are every week instead of being twice. They're twice a month right now, and they're changing to every Thursday because we've had such a great response and people have such a great time.
Rachna Muldoon visited the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio last week. You can learn more about the Big Picture House at their Facebook page. And that's almost all the time we have for this Monday night edition of Ozarks at Large. Support for KUAF comes from Main Street Rogers and the Downtown Rogers Restaurant Week, running this week through Saturday. Restaurants, diners, cafes, coffee shops, and drive-ins will showcase their food, flavors, and specialties during this week. A list of participants and menus available online at mainstreetrogers.com. And Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. All of us at Ozarks at Large and KUAF certainly thank everyone who helps support public radio in Northwest and Western Arkansas and parts of Oklahoma and Missouri. Thank you for your support of KUAF. If you haven't contributed this spring to KUAF, we make it very easy to do at any time, including right now. If you appreciate having Ozarks at Large on in the evening and performance today and great classical music after that, please remember all of these programs cost us money, programs that you can't find anywhere else on your radio dial. You can support us right now online very simply and securely at supportkuaf.com. If you put supportkuaf.com into your browser, it will come up with a website that is very simple for you to use and make the contribution of your choice. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Crosses. For Christina Thomas and Antoinette Grajeda, I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for listening.